You are listening to the novel and fascinating on-demand audio program called Every Little Thing from Gimlet Media. It begins now.
Thank you for calling the Every Little Thing helpline. ELT is here to answer your pressing factual questions. After the tone, please leave a detailed description of your question and the best way to reach you once your question has been answered. Please note in your message if this is a factual emergency. Goodbye.
Hi, my name is Andrew Conkling. My question is about running. I love to run, listening to podcasts, of course, while I'm running. And I've noticed that my second toe, which is longer than my first, gets really sore sometimes. And I'm wondering if there's a neat trick that I can, haven't looked up yet, but that I could figure out for how to alleviate that.
Hello, this is Andrew.
Hey, Andrew, it's Flora.
Hi.
So, good news. I have some answers, I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And what I found out, I feel like actually will change the way that I live my life.
No kidding.
Okay, so when I heard your question, I was like, I know exactly who I have to call for this.
Oh, cool.
His name is Dan Lieberman.
Hello.
Hi, is this Dr. Lieberman?
Speaking.
This is Flora Lichtman.
Oh, hi, Flora. Hey, you know what? I'm just getting out of the shower. Can you call back in like 5 minutes?
So Dan's going to go dry off. And in the meantime, I want to tell you something about your toes.
Okay. Okay.
There's a name for your toes, having a second longer toe.
Okay.
And that name is Morton's toe, named after this orthopedist, Dudley Morton.
Oh.
So like the medical condition is Morton's toe. But it also goes by lots of other names, including Greek foot.
Why is it called that?
Because it was a standard of beauty in ancient Greece, apparently.
Hmm.
And this toe structure is in all of these famous pieces of art, like Venus de Milo has your toe structure.
I see.
Michelangelo's David, your toes. Lady Liberty, your toe structure.
Huh. I've never looked at Lady Liberty's feet or David's for that matter, but or Venus's for that matter. I've never looked at any of those feet.
Well, now you will.
Yes, totally.
And by the way, Lady Liberty wears size 879 sandals. I just thought you should know that.
That is delightful. It's funny.
So back to your question, which was, what can you do about your second longer toe pain? And I called Dan because Dan is an evolutionary biologist. And he's super into feet. Like, he measures feet. He's very into how feet are shaped and how modern feet are different from ancient feet.
Okay, yeah.
And Dan is a huge runner.
Yes, yes. I was. I actually went for a run this morning, and then I just ended up working on a paper in my running clothes and realized I was getting stinkier and stinkier.
And Dan has an answer for you.
So it depends on where in the toe the pain is.
He basically said that one of the most common running injuries is a fracture of this bone behind the second toe.
Ah.
So it's possible that you're part of this, like, long history of toe pain, basically.
That's slightly reassuring.
But Dan also said that there is something that you can do, something that we all can do on behalf of our feet to make them stronger and less injury-prone. And that is to take our shoes off.
Shoes are designed to make the foot muscles not have to work as hard. So shoes are not unlike chairs, right? Chairs allow us to sit without expending any effort. Elevators, mm-hmm. escalators, shoes are no different. They increase comfort by decreasing the amount of muscular effort that we have to do.
Hmm. I never thought of shoes as an act of laziness.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So what do you wear when you run?
Well, I typically wear minimal shoes because I try to put my money where my mouth is, and I also just enjoy them.
Do you feel like your foot is more muscular? Like, is your foot ripped?
Oh, absolutely. I can measure it, too.
One thing that came up when the producers on the show were talking about this question was that it seemed like people had a lot of, like, people have a lot of toe shame. And you measure feet a lot. Have you noticed that?
Well, I think we are very squeamish in general about feet. Just think about all the places that don't allow bare feet into the store. Why do we have this squeamishness? I don't know. In fact, there's no question that shoes are in many ways much more unhygienic than going barefoot, because shoes create this anaerobic environment, which is perfect for funguses and bacteria and all kinds of other stuff to grow.
You mean in the shoe?
In the shoe,
yeah.
Sure, yes. I mean, look, I've measured thousands of people's feet, including lots of people who've never worn a shoe in their life. And I can tell you that the most disgusting feet that I've measured are those of shod people, not barefoot people. No question about it. But, you know, shoes are useful. I'm not anti-shoe, and I wear them all the time. but I'm not... I enjoy being barefoot. It's fun. It feels good.
It's funny. This summer, I was at the beach, and I realized I hadn't been barefoot outside in a really long time, like maybe since last summer. And my feet were really sensitive, and I felt this wave of nostalgia for a time gone by when I would spend most of the summer, you know, barefoot and running around.
Well, there's no question that most people, when they go barefoot, find it a pleasurable experience. Your foot is certainly one of the most innervated part of the bodies in terms of sensory nerves, and along with lips and fingertips and penises and et cetera. So, but there's a lot of sensory information that comes from your foot. You know, I mean, you just watch people take off their shoes, and they often just start smiling as they walk on the grass or wherever, and enjoy all that lovely sensory input, which we deny ourselves a lot. So it is a great pleasure. So take your shoes off.
That's great.
Yeah, that was the part that is going to change my life. What about you? Do you think you'll take your shoes off more?
Yeah, totally. What comes to mind when I hear that is just thinking about what all the times that, you know, I send my kids out in our backyard, but I say, oh, put your shoes on, you know? But I think I'm totally just going to be like, yeah, just skip them, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never really thought about it in such a, like, holistic way, you know?
Yeah, me neither. And now, you know, you can show your feet off and remind people that they're the Greek standard of beauty.
Yeah. And maybe just, like, don't imagine my feet. Just imagine a sculpture of my feet, because they'll probably be idealized, right?
Exactly.
Hey, it's Deborah. Okay, here's my question. What is a water chestnut? And where does it grow? And why is it always delivered in a can? I remember loving them. My mom made them in stir fry and, of course, bacon wrapped water chestnuts. And I haven't eaten any since then. But I still don't know the answer. So I hope that you can help me out. What is a water chestnut? Bye.
Hello.
Hi, is this Deborah?
Hi, it's Deborah, yeah.
Hey, Deborah, this is Catherine calling from Every Little Thing.
Hi, Catherine.
I'm here to answer your burning question about water chestnuts.
I'm just dying to know.
Why is this your burning question?
Well, you know, when somebody asks, what have you always wondered, water chestnuts always pop into my head.
Like, people are like, what's a thing you would like to know? And you're always like, the one mystery that always comes to mind is, what is a water chestnut?
Yes. Maybe I don't want to ask the bigger, more burning, unanswerable question.
Do you have other mysteries? I don't want to take them all from you.
Well, you know, I have two teenagers. So, like, my big question is, how do I help them find their way? That's the big one.
Yeah. I'm supremely unqualified to help you with that question, but the question I can help you answer is about water chestnuts. So,
excellent.
Okay, so here we go. To help me answer this question, I called Eileen Yin Fei Lo. She is a super famous chef. She has 11 cookbooks full of Chinese recipes. She lives in the States, but she's from Hong Kong. and she's written about water chestnuts.
You know, I have so many cookbooks that you can look around. Many of them are very easy stir fry and have water chestnut in it. And I also have salads using water chestnut too. So, you know, many things. Water chestnut is one of the very important ingredient in Chinese cooking.
Why do you love to cook?
Because I love to eat.
Okay, so this is what she told me about what they are.
It's a root, you know, like almost like a root, but you can say it's a vegetable.
They are not chestnuts. They are not nuts. They're a vegetable.
A vegetable.
How disruptive to your sense of water chestnuts is this information?
Well, I embrace it because I think a water chestnut is a vegetable I can get behind more easily than some of the other options. I'm excited.
It's a really interesting plant, actually. It's actually a grass.
It's grass, wow.
It's like these long grass stems, and the water chestnut is this bulbous thing that grows underground in the roots system.
Really?
Yes, and it's known as the Chinese water chestnut because they grow in China.
Right.
And they're grown in paddies underwater.
Really? So that maybe is where the water part comes from.
Yes. So the ones you ate when you were growing up, they were canned, right?
That's what I remember, yes.
Okay. So this is a thing that Eileen is somewhat adamant about, is that fresh ones are much better.
Which is pretty much true of all canned vegetables, I think we can agree.
In the summertime when they have plenty, we peel it and we put in a skewer. And then laying out after dinner, everybody take one. And for dessert.
For dessert?
Yeah, for dessert.
What does it taste like raw?
Sweet. Crunch. Have you ever taste jicama?
Yeah.
It's more sweet than more hot, no crunch, than jicama.
So everybody's got to try fresh ones.
Everybody should try fresh one, yes.
There you go.
I will eat them more. I will seek out the fresh ones.
Eat them fresh.
It's awesome. I'm excited.
I'm sorry I can't help you with the greater mysteries of life, but if you ever have any more small mysteries.
I'll know where to come. Every little thing, for sure. Thanks, Catherine. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
The show isn't over yet. After the break, more reporting on burning questions. Listen to the advertisements. You are still listening to the same show that you clicked on initially.
Hey, Flora. I'm a huge fan of baseball, and I believe that one of the things that makes the sport so great is that no matter where you are in the country and no matter what team you support, you will always sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game during the seventh inning stretch. I was wondering, how did this become such a widespread ritual? Like, even if you don't even really like baseball, you probably know some or all the lyrics. Thank you, and love the show.
Hello.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Every Little Thing. Is this Ian?
Yeah, this is Ian.
First of all, thank you for your question.
Yeah, no problem.
Are you a baseball fan?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But also that's just something that I grew up with. We would sit on the porch during the summer and listen to the Indians on the radio. And so that's sort of a nostalgic thing, too, for me.
Do you like the song?
Actually, no. It's not a pleasing song. Like, the music's pretty bad. The lyrics are very simple.
You hate the song.
I don't think anyone particularly likes the song.
Well, actually, I found someone who disproves this theory. His name is Andy Strasburg. He worked in baseball for 40 years. And this is who I called to help me answer your question. And he loves this song.
I can't even imagine why anyone would hate it. No, Absolutely not. There's nothing to hate here. It's a perfect song.
How often would you say you listen to this song?
Probably 3 or 4 times a week, but I have to explain why. First of all, my doorbell in our house plays "Take Me Out to the Ball
Game." No way. Are you in your house right now?
Yeah, I am.
Can I hear it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, hold on. Here we go.
Oh, yeah.
Got a great ring, doesn't it?
It's great.
And then I have the largest collection of recordings of "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" in the world. I've got over 500 different recordings of "Take Me Out to the Ball Game."
I wouldn't have even known there were that many.
Oh, there's more than 500. I've only got about 500.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know there was that many. I thought there was, I don't know, half a dozen maybe.
Oh no, this thing is huge.
Okay.
So Andy loves this song so much that he wrote a book about it called Baseball's Greatest Hit. And so he is the perfect person to answer your question. And he said the song began its life just as a regular pop song.
You have to start at the beginning, 1908, with Jack Norworth, who actually wrote the song.
So the writer, Jack, had never actually been to a baseball game. According to the story, he just saw a billboard advertising a game and he wrote up this song. And it was a popular song at the time. And I found the very first version recorded of it.
Katie Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad.
Wait, first of all, there are more words to it.
Yeah, it's, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like there are all these lyrics about Katie Casey. She's a girl who, like, wants to go on a date, and the guy's like, I'm going to take you to a show. And she's like, no, I'm not that kind of girl. I'm a ball game girl. And then it's the part that we sing is just the chorus.
No, I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never.
All right, you get the idea.
Yeah, okay, so it's actually the girl saying that, right?
Yeah, she's like, take me on a date.
Okay.
Yeah, and I read that this song was a huge hit that year. But during this time, it was not at all associated with actual ball games. Like, it wasn't played in the ballpark until the 1920s or maybe the 1930s. It was just, like, on the radio, and they would play it in movie theaters during intermissions and stuff, but it wasn't a ball game thing. Andy told me that the story of its popularity really picks up in the 1970s.
It was the 1970s when it really took off and became part of the experience of going to a baseball game and being sung in the seventh inning. And it actually took place and happened in Chicago at Comiskey Park. Bill Veeck, who was the owner at that time, noticed that Harry Carey, who was their broadcaster, would sing along with the organist in the seventh inning, and fans would get up and stretch their legs. And so Bill Veeck asked Harry Carey if he would sing it on the PA system for the ballpark. And Harry said, no way, because he wasn't a good singer. What Bill Veeck did is he snuck a microphone into the broadcast booth and turned it on when Harry started to sing. And the fans loved it. And the fans got into it. Harry saw the reaction of the fans. So what Harry did was he embraced it.
All right.
That's a Harry Carey trademark. He would always scream, all right.
All right. Let me hear you. Good and loud. A 1. A 2. A 3. Hey.
We used to do that 1, 2, 3 in college whenever we would sing a song.
He leaves the Chicago White Sox and goes over to the Chicago Cubs. And now those games are televised on WGN. And now the entire world is watching baseball games. And at the seventh inning break, they're watching Harry lead the fans at Wrigley Field in singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
So basically, Harry Carey is the reason you sing this song.
Okay.
According to Andy, Take Me Out to the Ball Game is now the third most sung song in the U.S. You want to guess what the first two are?
Star Single Banner.
Mm-hmm.
And
Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I actually asked Andy what his favorite version was. I have to play this one for you. Because I found it, I'd never heard this, and I found it very unusual. And it's the Ink Spots.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the ball.
It makes me want to go see a game so bad.
Yeah?
Well, I'm not at home anymore. I mean, I moved away from home, so it kind of makes me want to go listen to a game with my dad.
Does this answer your question?
Yeah, this answers my question. Thank you.
I want you to know the helpline is always open. We are here for you. If you have a question for us, give us a ring. 347-464-9626. I'm going to give you a pause while you get a pen. 347-464-9626. No question is too small for us, as you heard. We'll be back weekly in October. I can't wait. Talk to you then.
Every Little Thing is made by Flora Littman, Catherine Wells, Christine Driscoll, Gofen Putupwele, Eric Menel, Devin Taylor, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Dara Hirsch scored and mixed this episode. Every Little Thing requests your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. The show is over.